what a man wanted to hear. We don't retain the queries that don't make the paper, she said slowly and deliberately. That wouldn't make any sense.
Good.
Mr. Marshall nodded. The newspaper's legal counsel is in my office. Why don't I take you there and let you explain to the detectives that we don't keep, retain, the queries that don't make the paper? Hearing her words in Mr. Marshall's mouth was glorious. She must have chosen the right ones, truthful but deceptive. The letter about the fountain would have been tossed by week's end, but for now it was still in her files. The waiting police officers were homicide detectives, men who didn't look much different from the city desk reporters, only in their 40s, aged by their jobs and the bad habits those jobs encouraged. They were disappointed to hear that it was policy to throw out unpublished letters, and they pushed Maddie to remember whatever details she could. She said that she did not remember the sender's name, only that he was a man. He said he had been passing the fountain late at night. No one was sure how long the lights had been out at that point, but DPW was dubious that the problem was one of long-standing. She had been told that only a few days could have gone by before someone noticed the dark fountain.
Any idea whose body it is? Mr. Marshall asked the detectives. The cause of death, how it even got there.
It.
The body's in pretty bad shape.
The detective seemed to watch Maddie's face to see if that detail would rattle her.
A Negro woman. We won't say more for now.
You aren't telling us everything you know, so we're not telling you everything we know. How childish grown men could be. In a way women never were, not in Maddie's experience. Sullen and grumpy, still playing by the Sandlot rules, obsessed with fairness and stature. Of course women cared about stature too, but they learned early to surrender any idea that life was a series of fair exchanges. A girl discovered almost in the cradle that things would never be fair. As if to prove that point, Mr. Marshall dismissed her, as if she were of no importance to the meeting. She was an instrument, no different from a typewriter or her telephone headset. She conveyed information, but she couldn't tell you how she did it. Maddie sliced open that day's mail, seething. How many larger crimes lurked in the city's petty complaints? But an hour later, when the detectives were gone, she was summoned back and asked to bring any files that she thought might be relevant. The editor-in-chief had a sumptuous office, which she had been too overwhelmed to notice on her first visit. An immense desk, possibly mahogany, a leather chair, a green-shaded lamp. Guests sat in upholstered wing chairs. It was a stark contrast to the newsroom's dingy chaos.
I want to be clear about what just happened, Mr. Marshall said, hunched forward over his clasped hands. We are good citizens. We cooperate with the police as necessary. But we want to know what we have before we share it. Once the police saw your files, we might not ever have seen them again. They could have been seized as evidence.
I don't think there's much here, she said, handing him the manila folder where she kept her problems, the letters that she took on and solved, the invisible Mrs. helpline. Or was she a miss again? Neither honorific seemed right for her. Mrs. was Mrs. Milton Schwartz, who had run her household with ruthless ease. Miss was a 17-year-old girl.
Why don't you take the letter out and read it to us? He suggested. After all, your fingerprints would already be on it. We can't keep the evidence pristine, but we can try to avoid contaminating it further.
She located the letter easily, its envelope stapled to it, although the only information that provided was the postmark, establishing it had been mailed in Baltimore last week. The inquiry was straightforward. The name, Bob Jones, sounded even phonier now. We don't check people's identities if we're not using the letter in the column, she explained. She realized that Mr. Heath had not been invited to the meeting, and this made her feel proud. Although she couldn't have said why.
Not much there, Mr. Marshall said. I confess I was hoping it would give us a little lead, something we could get out in front with.
Dead Negro woman in fountain, said the city editor, Harper. I wouldn't even lead the metro section with it. Diller says he hears that it's probably a woman who disappeared earlier this year, a cocktail waitress from the Flamingo. Shell Gordon's joint? The Afro's been all over it, but there doesn't seem to be any real news there.
The newspaper's lawyer was staring at Maddie.
You're the woman who tricked Stephen Corwin.
She blushed. I wouldn't say tricked. I simply asked him to write to me. Mr. Marshall picked up the thread.
And now here you are, making a random call to DPW and a body comes up.
She felt as if she were being accused of something. Meddling? Dishonesty? Neither characterization was entirely off base, but shouldn't she be praised as a go-getter? An employee with instinct and promise? She decided to say nothing. The moment was pregnant. Something was going to happen. She was going to be rewarded or singled out. At the very least, they were going to tell Mr. Heath that she was not his personal secretary. Instead, she was dismissed for the second time that day.
Thank you for your help, Madeline.
She had not walked 10 feet before she heard boisterous laughter from the editor's office. She did not believe that the laughter was at her expense, but it did not make her feel any better to realize how quickly they had moved on to some private hilarity. Miserable, she went to the ladies' room to splash cold water on her face, hoping to erase the high color in her cheeks. The ladies' room was one of the few calm and relatively clean places on the entire floor. It even had a tiny anteroom with a naugahyde love seat, although the only woman who ever lingered there was Edna Sperry, the labor reporter. She parked herself on the love seat with her copy, coffee, and cigarettes, emerging at the last possible moment to file, preemptively cursing the changes she anticipated to her prose. Mrs. Sperry? Maddie ventured, after washing her hands and splashing water on her face.
Yes?
I'm Madeline Schwartz. I work on the helpline column. But I'd like to be a reporter here. I know I'm starting late. I'm just past 35. After all, 37 was only two notches past 35, whereas almost 40 sounded like death. May I ask you? The older woman flicked her eyes across Maddie, flicked her cigarette ash into the brimming ashtray at her side, and made a sound that could have been a laugh. Maddie refused to be intimidated. May I ask how you became a newspaper woman? Edna definitely laughed then. What's so funny?
The minute you began, may I ask, you've lost any edge you have, she said.
I didn't know I needed an edge. Edna was no different from one of the old battle axes she'd had to charm at the synagogue and Hadassah back in the day, when she had been a young bride, just beginning to serve on committees.
You need authority. Confidence. Do you know how I got into this business?
Maddie, thinking the question rhetorical, did not answer.
Well, you should. If you want to be a reporter, the first step is to prepare for every interview, to go in knowing as much as possible about your subject.
Maddie was thrown, but she didn't want to show it.
I didn't think of you as a subject, more of a colleague. That was your first mistake, Edna said.
It was a moment, that make or break second in which one's entire future depends on reacting the right way. Maddie had experience with such moments. Just like when she was not quite 18, standing expressionless in a Northwest Baltimore driveway, watching movers carry furniture, stowing her dreams away in the back of a truck, as certainly as they loaded a yellow silk sofa. Just as when, a month later, she met Milton at a dance and realized he was at once worldly and naive. A man she could fool.
Thank you for your time, she said sweetly. She was thinking, no, my first mistake was trying to get a woman to help me. I do better with men. I always do better with men. That night, Ferdy laughed at her too.
Because she's a Negro, Maddie. That's why it wasn't a big deal when she went missing.
I know that, she said. I'm not naive. But she was hurt. She had thought her anger over the callousness of the men at the Star was a kind of tribute to her lover. So what if they could never go out in public? It wasn't because of race. It had more to do with her marital status. And maybe his, although she remained unclear what that status was.
There was a time when the death of a Negro woman didn't make the local papers, Ferdy said. I don't blame your bosses for not caring until Cleo Sherwood was found. A girl like her, she got around. The Afro only made a big deal of it because the mother was so upset, and because Cleo worked at Shell Gordon's place. He's waist high in a lot of stuff.
Did you know her? Again, that laugh.
We don't all know each other, Maddie. It's a big town.
She was drifting off to sleep before she realized he had not answered her question. And by then it seemed too wife-like to follow up. What was it to her, whom Ferdy knew or had known? Yet Maddie couldn't let the subject drop. So much about the discovery of Cleo Sherwood seemed to parallel the death of Tessie Fine, but in a through-the-looking-glass way. No search parties, no attention, no official cause of death, not yet. No swift arrest, no outrage. The one thing the two deaths had in common was Maddie. A coincidence, but when one is the coincidence, it's hard not to find the fact momentous. There would be justice for Tessie, even if Corwin never revealed the identity of his accomplice. But what would there be for Cleo? How had she gotten there? Why had she gone there? Was she alive when she arrived at the fountain? Where did you say that Cleo Sherwood worked? That seemed a fair question, a safe question.
The Flamingo Club, Ferdy said. Maddie, don't.
Don't what?
Don't get involved in this.
How would I get involved? Even she could hear the false notes in her voice.
Let's see. How would Madeline Schwartz insert herself into a murder case? Well, she might join a search party. She might give an interview to a newspaper man.
I didn't.
She might write a letter to some pervert who's going to end up on death row, then finagle her way into writing about that for the newspaper. There's something about you and that newspaper, Maddie. Moth to a flame, if you ask me.
I work there now. It's my job. I'm trying to get ahead. How does that make me any different from you? Ferdy did not speak for a while after that. And in the silence, Maddie's question took on more layers and meanings than she had intended. They were in bed. They were always in bed. Sometimes they got up and drank beer and ate meals, but they never seemed to get dressed all the way. Once or twice they had tried sitting on the sofa to watch a television show, but it had felt unnatural, upright and side by side, their clothes on. Ferdy lugged her television into the bedroom and propped it on the bureau, where they sometimes watched the Moonlight movie on Channel 11. This bedroom was their entire world. Ferdy said,
I think you...
then stopped. Maddie was thrilled and terrified. Few things were as provocative as a lover telling you who you were. Go on.
I don't have the words exactly. I think you felt, I don't know, kind of hidden from the world, or stuck between two worlds. You're not Mrs. Schwartz no more. but you're not her, either. You liked it when your name was in the newspaper. You wanted to be there again. Not in a story, on top of a story. A byline.
It was exactly what she wanted. When she had given Bob Bauer the story about Corwin, her story, they had printed her name at the top of the article in italicized type, based on a correspondence with Madeline Schwartz, part of the search party that discovered Tessie Fine's body. But she knew now that this did not count as a byline. It was not, in some ways, even her name. But then, what woman actually had her own name? Maddie's maiden name was her mother's married one. Had she chosen Ferdy because marriage was literally forbidden to them, against the law in Maryland? Could she even claim she had chosen him? They were living in a bubble, in this room, hiding out from what, she wasn't sure. She wasn't afraid of Milton. In fact, she liked to fantasize about Milton's discovering that she had a lover, especially this one. Ferdy didn't have to run around chasing tennis balls lobbed by Wally Weiss to stay firm. But Seth could never know. A teenage boy could not cope with his mother's romances, nor should he be expected to. What would happen when she was divorced at last, when she re-entered the real world, whatever the real world was at this point? Would she marry again? Did she want to marry again? Maybe, probably. But for now, she wanted only this. Whatever it was. This and the newsroom. There were other women there, women who wrote about the port, the world, Washington. Edna. Her cheeks flamed at how easily the woman had dismissed her. In bed with Ferdy that night, she didn't tell him any of these things. Not the encounter with Edna, which she found shameful. Or that she planned to cultivate men for her ambitions. Though he would be jealous, flatteringly so, she was sure. If Ferdy were her endgame, she would have desired this jealousy, required it, like with Milton. Only Ferdy was not, could not, be her endgame. Even if it were legal. But it wasn't legal, not in Maryland. That wasn't her fault, and it wasn't something she could change, even if she wanted to. They made love again. Sometime around 3 a.m., she became aware of his creeping away. He stroked her hair, kissed her one more time. She thought, maybe I should change back to my old style. Shorter, more bouffant. Edna wore her hair that way. Most of the women at the newspaper did, come to think of it. No. No. Maddie reminded herself. She was going to cultivate the men. The battle axe. I stab out my cigarette in the standing metal ashtray provided in the ladies' room. Most of the butts are mine. The other women on staff long ago conceded that this women's bathroom, one of only two on the floor, is my private lair. It is small and mean and utilitarian. Like me, some would say. But never to my face. I go to my desk and start working the phones for a story I plan to file later this evening. The bosses hate how I schedule my day, but I'm too good at what I do for them to make me change. Still, they complain. It's an afternoon paper, Edna. What if there are developments overnight or in the morning? What if we have to chase something in the morning papers? As if anyone in town has ever scooped me. I come in when I please, make notes on how today's copy was butchered, scream at Cal, then start writing tomorrow's copy. I file about 8 or 9, so Cal has to move my stories. I like working with Cal. He's a little scared of me, as he should be. But still, he tinkers. Today, he has all but tinkered his way into a correction box, and you better believe it will say, due to an editing error, something they are loath to admit, but I make him say it. I will talk to Cal about this later and scare him sufficiently so he won't try it again for several months. He's like a dog, a dumb one, who has to be trained over and over again.
Frankly, I should be allowed to hit him with a rolled-up newspaper when he misbehaves. There are plenty at hand, and I think my lessons would stick better. My desk looks like a fortress, one of those children's castles made with large, lightweight blocks, only the blocks are my files, stored in cardboard boxes. I wasn't trying to wall myself off from the newsroom, not at first. I simply wanted my files nearby, and I ran out of space in the drawers. I know where everything is, can find anything I need in less than 10 minutes, much faster than anyone in the library pulling clips. But no one else would be able to locate a specific file in my little warren. Perhaps that is by design. I have a highly specialized beat, one I practically invented at the Star. They call me the labor reporter, which means I track the city's various unions. Inevitably, I am often the secondary on big stories coming out of the port or Bethesda. Cops and firefighters and teachers. Labor touches everything in Baltimore. The only union about which I have never filed a story is the Newspaper Guild, which might end up striking by year's end. If it does, I will not join my colleagues on the picket lines. I will claim that would make me appear biased. I wouldn't cross a picket line. That would be foolhardy. Make for hard feelings once the strike is resolved, and strikes are always resolved. But I won't march in one, either. The truth is, I hate unions, and negotiated for one of the so-called exempt slots when I joined the Star, so I'm not a dues-paying member of the Guild. Marching is for children. Strikes are games that distract the workers from the singular fact that no one is on their side. Not management, not their own leadership. Some of my colleagues have tried to argue that it's biased for me not to be in the union, but I think it makes me more objective. My stories, my relationships with Baltimore's union leaders speak for themselves. The fact is, the various union bosses prefer to talk to me because I don't cut them any slack. My questions, direct, skeptical, even adversarial, often help them see the defects in their strategies. I have been the labor reporter 11 years, at the Star for 19 years, a newspaper reporter for 24 years, 28, if you count my years on the school paper at Northwestern. I do. Add the 2 years I spent stringing for the paper in my hometown of Aspen, Colorado in high school, and that puts me at 3 decades of newspaper work. I was never the first woman in the newsroom, but there were only a few of us. And fewer still who wanted to do the hard, masculine beats. It helped, of course, that I am homely as a mud fence. Oh, I know some people would say I'm unfair to myself, but I was small and thin as a teenager, coming of age at a time when the hourglass figure was worshipped. And my nose, while not unsightly, is too big for my face. Other women dealt this hand might have gone the Diana Vreeland route or emulated Martha Graham. I can't be bothered. At my first 2 jobs in Lexington, Kentucky, and then in Atlanta, I ignored men completely, confident that I would be moving on very quickly. What was the point of romance in places I would never deign to linger? But I am, despite what some of my colleagues say behind my back, a woman with a woman's needs. And when I landed in Baltimore, I considered the men available to me. Colleagues, cops, assistant state's attorneys, labor bosses. Those were the sort of men that a female reporter met. None were to my liking. I found a gentle young man, a junior high school English teacher, drinking coffee at Pete's Diner and fixed my sights on him. Shy and inexperienced, he was so grateful for my romantic interest that it never occurred to him that he wasn't obligated to propose. We have 2 children now. Well into their teens. And if the early years were hell, they were. The good news is that I no longer remember all the particulars of how we survived it. We did. That's all that matters. And now here comes this housewife who has decided she can waltz into the Star and become a reporter just like that. Certainly many people on staff have made similar journeys, rising from clerical jobs, even the switchboard. But they started young and humble. This one, She doesn't burn to know things. I'm sure of it. She wants the accessories of a newspaper woman's life. A byline, a chance to perch on a man's desk and swing her pretty legs while bumming a smoke. One of the reasons that I seldom smoke at my desk is because it's a fire hazard, but also by meeting cigarettes out to myself. Rewards for stories filed, phone calls made. I make myself efficient. I call it my three C's, copy, then cig, and coffee. I proof the pages in the ladies' room, and most of the women on staff have learned not to bother me. Everyone knows that the pretty girl only got the job as Heath's assistant because she's pretty. But that post is a dead end. She should have tried for a job in the Sunday section. She would have been a natural, writing up brides and engagements. Not that many Jewish weddings are featured in the paper, but there's always a Meyerhoff, the occasional Herschel. I'm often mistaken for a Jewess, but my family were Scots. Tough and durable, as hard as the marble they quarried. Again, people think this means I should have sympathy for unions, and again, it is quite the opposite. Unions work for average people, and they are a godsend for the incompetent. If you are very good at what you do, a union holds you back. I wonder what my own colleagues would think if they knew I've been contacted by Agnew, who's running for governor this year. Not that it will be an easy road for a Republican. He offered me the press secretary's job, said it could lead to something in his administration. I countered that I want to be in his cabinet, preferably commerce. Then I reached out to Congressman Sickles, who has the best shot of taking the Democratic nomination, and told him that Agnew wants me. Come November, I'm in a win-win. My agreements with the two camps prove that I'm unbiased, right? I've had enough of newspaper life. Too many of these pretty girls trip-trapping through the newsroom in their high heels, thinking it's fun and exciting. They even want to date newspapermen. I've made a lot of mistakes in my time, but that's not one of them. June 1966. After her disastrous conversation with Edna, and Maddie was no fool, she knew she had fumbled it badly. She took quick and quiet stock of what she had, what she wanted, and what she needed. She made subtle changes to her appearance, toning down her almost too fashionable clothing, putting her iron-straightened hair up into a chignon. She couldn't stop straightening it, Ferdy would be upset. She looked at what she thought of as her successes so far, stumbling on Tessie's body near the Arboretum, throwing Mr. Bauer a shred of knowledge to divert him from focusing on her, calling the city public works department about the fountain. Coincidences, yes. But what was the one common element? Maddie. She decided not to emphasize the role of luck when she asked Mr. Bauer if he would go to lunch with her and advise her about her career. He squinted at her, perplexed.
Where?
Here, at the paper.
No, I mean, where do you want to eat?
The New Orleans Diner. It was a few blocks away, a place where clerks and secretaries grab lunches on the go, although Maddie almost always brown-bagged it to save money. Some reporters ate there too, but not many. The reporters preferred the seafood restaurant on the nearby pier. Or, if senior, indulgent two-hour, three-martini meals at dark, hushed places after the final deadline. They bobbled back to the office on wavelets of gin, but that didn't matter so much with their daily deadlines behind them. They had all afternoon and into the evening to catch a second wind. Maddie would have loved to go to such a place for lunch, but if she suggested it, Mr. Bauer might think she had something else in mind. Besides, she wanted to pick up the check. Over their lunches, tuna salad and a tab for her, a deviled ham sandwich, and coffee for him. She said, I know I'm not a reporter, but I think I could be a good one, if they would let me. And I don't mean those silly things that Cal tries to give me.
Let you,
Mr. Bauer said, No one's gonna let you do anything. You have to make things happen for yourself.
What if I found a story, a good one, that I reported on my own time?
You'd probably be poaching on someone else's beat, he said. That's not gonna fly.
If the story is being ignored, I'm not really poaching, am I?
You sound like a kid with your hand in the cookie jar, trying to get off on some technicality.
But he was amused by her doggedness, she could tell. He had a little crush on her. That was okay. Maddie was used to it. All her life, men had been getting crushes on her. The trick was to maintain this delicate emotion, to keep it from tilting into something serious, something with hurt feelings and wounded pride.
So you think there's some story that's going to be missed if you don't follow up on it?
That girl. The woman. In the lake. He shook his head.
That's not a story.
Why not?
She was in her 20s, not taking care of her own kids, out for a good time. Wasn't even married to her kids' fathers. She goes out on a date with some strange guy, a chop suey date. He kills her, so what?
You know, if I were found dead in my apartment tomorrow, someone could say similar things about me. Maddie did not really believe this, but she thought it a good argument. I'm just a woman who left my husband. My own son doesn't want to live with me. That's why I didn't want to talk to you that day. Because you would have had to tell that part, and my son Seth would have been so embarrassed. Bob Bauer thwacked the ketchup bottle ineffectively. Maddie was about to take it from him, but the waitress intervened, swift and familiar. She appeared to know him well, had joked with him about his order. Deviled ham, you devil.
Why are you trying so hard to get a job as a reporter, Maddie? Most of the women in this business, they get in young or they marry into it, and most of them are battle axes, in my opinion.
The world is changing, she said.
Not for the better, I'm afraid.
What about Margaret Bork White?
Even Maddie realized she was grasping. Why was she talking about a photographer? Who were the famous women journalists?
The exception that tests the rule. There will be exceptions, always. Do you believe yourself to be exceptional?
She took the daintiest bite possible from the messy sandwich, chewed more thoroughly than necessary. As a matter of fact, I do. And Martha Gellhorn. I meant to say Martha Gellhorn.
Then maybe you can turn this story into something. Tell you what, tomorrow on your lunch break, let's walk down to the cop shop. I'll introduce you to John Diller, and he can run you through some basics. How to pull a police report, for starters.
I met him briefly at headquarters the other day, but I don't think I've ever seen him in the newsroom.
He probably never will. He calls his information in to rewrite. Couldn't write a note to his mother, or even a grocery list, without a rewrite man on the other end of the phone. Other reporters call him Deputy Diller or Deputy Dog behind his back. We'll tell him that this is kind of a training mission. That way he won't get spooked about some gal he's never heard of making phone calls on his beat. Like I said, he's more cop than reporter. Blood runs blue. He knows everything that happens at the PD.
Not everything, Maddie thought. Blood rushing to her cheeks. The waitress.
They're talking about Cleo, Mr. B and the woman with him. I almost lean in and say I knew her, but that throws people. Being reminded that the waitress ain't deaf and dumb. It's a guaranteed way to get stiffed on the tip, let me tell you. I'm surprised when the woman with Mr. B picks up the check at lunch. More surprised that she leaves a good tip. Not that all women are bad tippers, but this woman doesn't look as if she knows much about hard work. And that's what makes a difference in tips. Lawyers are the worst, very stingy. But housewives, who've never held down a job, they can be just as bad. Maybe she's trying to impress Mr. B. I've been waiting on Mr. B for almost 10 years now.
I remember when he was younger, thinner. He says he's trying to reduce and orders deviled ham. I know him well enough that I'll give him a playful tap when he reaches for someone else's French fries. Of course, this woman doesn't order French fries. Why would a woman pick up the check for Mr. B? That isn't allowed. He told me once he has to pay for himself, always. That if I see him with a stranger, I should make sure he gets the check. But he lets this woman pay. How odd. She clearly isn't a romantic interest because then she definitely wouldn't have paid. Besides, he's married. He says happily, but I'm not convinced the word happily can be applied to any part of Mr. B's life, except maybe the newspaper. He likes his job. He doesn't want to go home. I know, because sometimes he comes in right before closing and drinks a very slow cup of coffee while I count my tips, talks to me about where he grew up, a town a lot like the one I come from, back in West Virginia. None of my business. My business is to get the food on the table, fast and hot. I've been waiting tables since I was 13, a leggy 13, who could pass for 16. My parents brought the family to Baltimore during the war for that Glenn Martin money. That didn't work out. Nothing worked out for them. They drank, they divorced, they got back together, which was worse than the drinking or the divorce. I had to find a way to escape, even if I was just 13. So I got a job at a place called Stacy's. Then I went to Werner's, and now I'm at the New Orleans Diner. The NOD, as we call it, is long and skinny. It has defeated many a waitress. I've seen a lot of young ones come and go because they weren't efficient. Too much trot, not enough glide. But I know how to cover the maximum ground with the minimum steps. Not that I was much smarter when I was a young pup. Turns out having cash money at the end of the day isn't the best thing for a teenage girl on her own. There were a couple of dark years where I almost became my mom. That's basically the story of every woman's life, right? You become your mother or you don't. Of course, every woman says she doesn't want to be her mother, but that's foolish. For a lot of women, becoming their mothers simply means growing up, taking on responsibility, acting like an adult is supposed to act. I hear the young women talking over their coffees, complaining about their mother's opinions, their rules. I'm on the mother's side, especially now, with the young people starting to act so odd, dress so odd, listening to crazier and crazier music. Still, I can sympathize with the girls, too. I remember being young, loving Elvis. I wish there had been a mother at home who railed at me a little, instead of a ghost in a bathrobe with a gin bottle who sneaked into my room while I was out and stole my tip money. Anyway, one day, I woke up pregnant, and that was that. The guy married me, but it was the only correct thing he ever did, and pretty soon I was 19 with a baby all alone. Now that baby, Sammy, is 14 years old, an honor student. I don't drink, and our house is neat as a pin. A rental, but neat as a pin. Whatever that means. How are pins neat? I go home every day and spend an hour with my feet up on the ottoman, a glass of Pepsi at my side. Because I do that, my legs are still worth a whistle. Not a trace of a varicose vein. Less trot, more glide. Elevate. Those are the secrets I would share with the younger girls, if they asked. But they never ask. They think they have all the answers. Even the ones who managed to survive at the New Orleans Diner. That name creates a lot of confusion, let me tell you. Some people think it's supposed to be New Orleans food, whatever that is, but it's just a joint that used to be on Orleans Street. Then the owner moved it to Lombard, so he decided to call it the New Orleans Street Diner to keep his trade, but he screwed up and left the word street off the menus and was too cheap to fix it.
He's a Greek, good with money and cooking, dumb about everything else. The woman at lunch with Mr. B, she asks him lots of questions, but not in a get-to-know-you way, not in a date way. I don't even need to hear the words to know that. This woman is like a dog stalking a squirrel, her body all a quiver. Whenever I see a dog like that, I wonder, what do you want with a squirrel? You're well fed, it's not gonna taste that good. Whatever that woman wants from Mr. B, it can't be as important as she thinks. Nothing is. I have learned that lesson over and over again. Nothing you want matters as much as you think it does. It's when I'm pouring Mr. B his third or fourth coffee that I hear her name, Cleo Sherwood. She worked in the kitchen at Werner's, although not very long. She wanted to be a waitress, but the bosses weren't having it. You had to be white to wait tables. They said it was what the customers wanted. Cleo was too pretty to be hidden away in the kitchen, in her opinion. She was right. Now she's dead. I saw it in the Star the other day. She's the first dead person I know. Outside, you know, the kind of people who are supposed to die, grandparents and such. It was weird, reading in the paper that Cleo was dead. In the lake yet. How does a girl end up in a fountain? Had to be man trouble. A woman dies young, it's man trouble. Thinking about Cleo makes me realize how short life is. How a person needs to live a little. When I count up my tips that afternoon and see that I've had an unusually good day, I find myself walking the opposite direction from my bus stop, over to the center of downtown, where the big department stores cluster. Hutzler's is too much. I could never imagine myself shopping at Hutzler's. It's 10 stories tall. There's so much to buy there that it runs over into another building. But Hochschild Kohn isn't as scary. I push through the revolving doors and march over to the perfume counter because it's the first thing I see. Perfume is wasted on me. I pretty much smell like bacon and French fries all the time, no matter how often I wash my hair. Not that anyone's around to notice. When Sammy started school, I decided to forget about men. I'll be all of 35 when he goes to college. That's not too old to have some fun. The woman at lunch, she smelled good. I'd like to smell like that. May I show you something? Asks a sales girl. Pretty dress, nice hair, gorgeous hands that make me want to thrust my own into my pockets. Instead, I asked to try a sample of Joy, but only because I remember the ads that say it's the costliest perfume in the world. The sales girl grudgingly hands me a piece of scented paper. Won't even give me so much as a daub on my wrist. I sniff it. No, that wasn't the scent on the woman at lunch with Mr. B. Guessing wildly, I point at a bottle with a dove on top of it. L'Air du Temps. I don't dare say the name. Even if I could speak French, my accent would make it sound ridiculous. Until 2 years ago, I didn't even know I have an accent. Then Sammy brought a friend home and I heard them talking in the kitchen. Why does your mom talk like that? Like what? Asked Sammy, my good boy, my darling boy. Like she's one of the Beverly Hillbillies. Unfair, because I don't sound like them at all. My West Virginia drawl has been eaten up by the Baltimore accents around me. My accent's kind of like Sammy, a nice result from an ill-advised collision. People like my voice. They like me. My regulars, their faces light up when I come to take their order. I am loved and beloved. I'm sure not going to try to say L'Air du Temps in front of some sales girl just so she can mock me. The cologne is cheaper, the girl says, but the bottle isn't as grand. I wouldn't buy perfume for the bottle, I assure her. I want her to know I'm no rube. But the cost? Jeez Louise. Who could pay that? Just to smell good. Why not just dab some vanilla extract behind your ears and call it a day? Yet, I am sure, when I inhale it, that this is the scent on the woman at lunch with Mr. B. And I know this is something I can never afford. No matter how many miles I glide up and down the New Orleans diner, no matter how many times newcomers look at the menu and make the joke, "What, no gumbo?" I always laugh as if I've never heard that one before, no siree. I'm as pretty as that woman. Or could be. I'm prettier than the girl at the perfume counter, with her pointy nose practically touching the ceiling. My legs are shapely, my skin has good color. I have a great kid, we're doing okay. But I'll never have a bottle of perfume with a dove on top. And it is probably just one of many bottles on that woman's bureau, sitting on one of those mirrored trays that fancy women have for their perfume. "I'm afraid it's not my style," I say. "It's too fruity." She smiles as if she's caught me out at something. I go home. I put my feet up for an hour, drink Pepsi, and watch Bowling for Dollars. It always makes me happy, that show. I don't know why. Sometimes I see ladies I know from around the neighborhood. I take my stockings off, rub cocoa butter into my legs. They look good. Less trot, more glide. I would have been a good car hop, the kind on roller skates. But you don't see those types of places in Maryland. I think they're a California thing, or wherever the weather is good more often than not. Sammy comes in, 14 years old, already 4 inches taller than I am, kisses me on the cheek without being asked. Last Mother's Day, he gave me Lily of the Valley perfume from Rite Aid, and you know what? That's better than Joy, or some bottle with an angel on top. L'air du temps. What does that even mean? Air something? I'll ask Sammy later. He gets straight A's at Hamilton Junior High, even in French. He's gonna set the world on fire, my boy. He's all I need. The best thing I'll ever do. I read the Star during commercials. Cleo Sherwood is truly yesterday's news, already gone from the paper. She told me once she was going to be famous, and I guess she is in a way, or was, for a day. I should have leaned in, told that lady. I knew her, Cleo Sherwood. Ask me some questions. Wouldn't that have been something? But you never want the customers to know how much you hear. They think their conversations are private. I've waited on secret lovers, people breaking up, men clearly doing stuff they're not supposed to be doing. I bring them their food, flirt with my regulars, otherwise pretend I'm deaf and practically blind. I move across the buckling linoleum floors of the New Orleans diner like a skater, the best at what I do. All glide, no trot. June 1966. Mr. Bauer dropped Maddie at the press room in police headquarters like a careless parent taking his child to the first day of kindergarten. He got her as far as the door, but it was on her to march in and claim her place. Even the Star's newsroom, messy and chaotic as it was, had not prepared Maddie for the dingy corner of the police headquarters that had been set aside for the men of the press. And they were all men. Although John Diller insisted there was one female cop reporter, Phyllis Basquet, who worked for the other afternoon paper, The Light. "Where is she?" Maddie asked skeptically.
"Driving around the Beltway, trying to get her mileage to match her expense account," Diller said.
Maddie suspected she was being played, but she nodded. If there were such a woman, Maddie could understand why she would want to avoid this room. The room, the whole building, in fact, was one of the most masculine places into which she had ever ventured, and not in a good way. Like, say, the bar at Hausner's. Or how she imagined the bar at Hausner's to be. Women still were not allowed in, a strange rule at a popular restaurant where reservations were not accepted. Then again, the line for tables was always down the block, so it wasn't hurting business. Yes, there were some female police officers and secretaries. This legendary Phyllis Basquette. But it smelled of men, of their sweat, their tobacco, of Brill cream and aftershave. Cheap, bad aftershave. Diller took her on a tour, first showing her how to pull a report. She read the brief details about Cleo Sherwood's disappearance, which had gone weeks without being noted. A bartender, Thomas Ludlow, said she had been picked up for a late date in the early morning hours of January 1st. The man was tall, slender, 30-ish, with a turtleneck under his black leather jacket. Cleo did not introduce him, and he was not someone the bartender had seen before. She wore a green blouse, leopard print slacks, a red car coat, and red leather driving gloves. Maddie wrote all these details down in her notebook, if only for the sake of doing something. "What's a number one female?" she asked Diller.
"A colored," he said. "Whites are number two, coloreds are number ones."
Diller led her from department to department, introducing the various sergeants. They perked up when she entered the room, but their faces fell as soon as Diller said she was his colleague. Her usual advantages with men did not seem to be working here, and when she tried to engage the captain in homicide on the matter of Cleo Sherwood, he was taciturn to the point of brusqueness.
"Not officially a homicide yet," he said. "Still waiting on the M.E.
Throughout all this, Diller, a small, dapper man, was impossible to read. Maddie assumed he was enjoying her discomfiture, that he was trying to haze her, so she would go away and leave him be. But he was the one who suggested, when their tour was done,
"Do you want to go to the morgue and see if they've made any headway on this Sherwood case?"
She wasn't sure, and her very lack of conviction told her she had to say yes. "Is her body still there?"
"I don't think they've released it to the family yet. Even if they have, it won't be a wasted trip. If you want to write about police matters, you should get to know the fellas over there."
"Oh, good, more fellas." The morgue was a shortish walk from the Star, a slightly longer one from Police HQ. Along the way, Diller talked about the tic-tac-toe killer, who preyed on the barflies along the waterfront, and pointed out an alley where one victim had been found. He also cheerfully detailed the wounds that the newspaper had hid behind the nickname, allowing readers to infer exactly what had happened to the bodies.
"Normally, I wouldn't tell such stories to a lady, but you're a reporter."
The Inner Harbor was a grimy place. The McCormick Spice Factory on the western edge filled the air with cinnamon, an odd contrast to the landscape. Maddie had seldom ventured as far south as the waterfront, although she had passed through on field trips to Fort McHenry when Seth was a child. She tried to imagine the sad, sick men who were being lured from bars and then left dead in vacant lots and alleys. But even they were treated with more respect than Cleo Sherwood. Their killer had been named, personified, and their deaths linked. How can Cleo Sherwood's death be anything but a homicide? She asked Diller. How does a body get into the fountain in January?
"Those are good questions," Diller said.
But he didn't try to answer them. The office of the medical examiner was a bright, sterile place. As Diller and Maddie entered, the men gathered at a gurney opened their tight circle, providing her an unobstructed view of the dead body lying there. It was a large man, his skin verging on purple. The body was positioned in such a way that she was staring straight at his crotch.
"This is Marjorie Schwartz,"
Diller said. "Madeline," she said. She thought about offering her hand, decided it was unsterile. "I had hoped to talk to you about Cleo Sherwood."
"Oh, right, the lady in the lake,"
the medical examiner said. Maddie made a mental note. She liked the nickname. Maybe using the term would humanize Cleo Sherwood's story, the way Tic-Tac-Toe Killer granted some dignity to his victims. The ME took her to the bank of drawers, began banging them open haphazardly, as if he didn't know where Cleo Sherwood's corpse might be. Maddie saw a man with stab wounds, several unremarkable corpses, and finally, the one she had come for. Her stomach churned, but she maintained her composure. Her face, she said. It was barely a face, and the color was neither white nor brown, more of a mottled gray. Did her mother have to see this?
Sister identified her.
How? Maddie wondered. Instead, she asked, "What caused this?"
"Water. 5 months of exposure. It's not optimal. We have been able to establish that she didn't drown, and there's no sign of trauma to the skeleton."
"No, I mean, how can it be anything but a homicide? How would a body even get in that fountain?"
"That's not our job," the medical examiner said. "We look for cause of death. So far, we can't find one."
"What are the possibilities?"
"Exposure, hypothermia, maybe she got stuck in the fountain. January 1st, the last day she was seen by anyone, was a mild day."
"You think she swam to the fountain fully clothed?" "She was fully clothed, right?" "And crawled into the fountain?" He read from a report.
"Subject was wearing leopard print slacks, a red wool coat, and a green blouse." Looking up, "You'd be amazed at what drunk people do. People on drugs, they're even crazier."
"You mean like LSD? Maddie had read scary things about the drug in Time magazine.
"In Baltimore? Her? More like heroin."
"Cleo Sherwood was a heroin addict."
"I didn't say that. It's not something we can know."
The men were watching her, gauging her, waiting for her to break. Maddie turned to Diller. "It's almost noon. Do you want to go to lunch? I'm famished." He took her to a tavern across the street.
"Babe Ruth's father once owned this joint," he said.
Maddie's stomach roiled when she saw some of the menu items, scrapple, shaved meats piled high. But she was determined to eat heartily, or at least make a show of eating heartily. She was used to pretending to be the fun female who indulged in greasy, fattening foods. She ordered a club sandwich and French fries, knowing she would simply nibble at the sandwich, then push it around her plate, breaking it into ever smaller pieces. When Diller requested a beer, she did the same. She had thought him unobservant, but he noticed how little food was making it to her mouth.
"Feeling off?"
"Trying to reduce," she said. "Some women eat cottage cheese. I get exactly what I want, then eat only a few bites." They ate. He ate in silence. "Have you talked to her family?" He seemed mystified by the question.
"Whose?"
"Cleo Sherwood. The lady in the lake." Trying out the phrase, making it hers.
"Why would I do that?"
"Why wouldn't you? Isn't that something you normally do when people die?" He finished the last bite of his burger, daubed his mouth with a napkin. He was not a coarse man. His manners were as good as Maddie's, possibly better. His shirt was snowy white, his shave barbershop clothes, his seersucker jacket crisp.
"She's colored."
"So?" He seemed to take the question seriously, if only because it was novel to him.
"They're not big stories. The colored dying, I mean, it happens all the time. It's the opposite of news, dog bites man. Plus,
You heard the Emmy, probably drugged. She got high and decided she could swim to the fountain.
But her death was so public and so mysterious.
That's why it got attention when she was found, but the Afro explored most of the avenues we might have gone down. She's just a girl who went out on a date with a bad guy. There's no story to that. She went out with a lot of guys, from what I hear.
What's a lot?
I don't know.
He was struggling to be proper.
I'm just saying what I heard. There are women, good time girls. It's how they pay the rent.
And she worked at that club, the Flamingo. It's sort of a playboy club for people who can't afford the real thing. Girls in skimpy outfits, slinging watered-down drinks, second-rate bands. The guy who owns it, he runs whores. Everybody knows that.
Maddie thought about what she had seen, the degradation of the body that had once been Cleo Sherwood. Nature was vicious. When Marilyn Monroe had died 4 years ago, people had said she was undone by her age, her fading looks, that she wanted to leave a beautiful corpse. No one leaves a beautiful corpse. Even if the death is free of trauma, only the embalmer's skill can make the body presentable once a few hours have passed. Every day, Maddie was a little less beautiful than she had been the day before. Every moment she lived, she also was dying. Monroe had been 36 when she died. Maddie had been just a few weeks shy of her 37th birthday when she decided to live.
What if I went to talk to the parents?
He shrugged. Kind of ghoulish, especially if you don't get a story out of it.